Hello, this is Albert Einstein. History myths fly around at the speed of light. Especially with that new internet thing you all seem to have. Thank goodness I have a direct connection to Professor Buzzkill, a fellow deep thinker who busts myths and takes names. I'm totally stoked there's a new episode. I was stuck on this new equation anyway. E equals MC something. Something.
Hello, hello, Buzzkillers. It's the professor here. And you're so lucky today because we have Dr. Lauren Turek on the line, on the internets, from Trinity University to talk to us about her new book, To Bring the Good News to All Nations, Evangelicals, Human Rights, and U.S. Foreign Relations. Hello, Dr. Turek. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great that you've come on the show. This book is so fascinating to me. And of course, we remind the Buzzkillers that it's on the Buzzkill bookshelf on the post, the blog post to this episode. Do you mind explaining about how you look at this, what you call the creation and development of an influential evangelical lobby?
Yeah, absolutely. So what I do in the book is I tell the story of how and why politically conservative and predominantly white evangelical groups in the United States became influential as a lobbying force in U.S. politics, and particularly on U.S. foreign relations, especially things like human rights and religious freedom, starting in the 1970s. So what I try to do is explain the spiritual and ideological beliefs that motivated these evangelicals to engage in foreign policy activism. I explain how they became effective as a foreign policy lobby. And then I provide some regional examples to show what that lobby looked like as it attempted to affect, you know, policy and life on the ground in these countries.
This is so interesting because, among many things, it's we're talking about a non-official party, but a non-official entity. This isn't the State Department going out technically and doing something, but it is, as you say, extremely influential.
Yeah, and they're part of this kind of very diffuse but connected group of global evangelicals that emerges by the 70s. So there are all these international influences, but they work in the U.S. They work very effectively in terms of advocating for particular political agendas, for particular foreign policy agendas, and they gain this kind of tremendous power by the 70s into the 1980s. So they're really influencing not just foreign policy, but domestic policy as well, of course. And we know that story from the rise of the religious right, but this is the kind of global side of that story of the rise of the religious right.
Yeah, that's one of the things we like to highlight on the show is the overlooked or the less studied or the less discussed aspects of something that people already seem to know a lot about. May I ask you right off, though, aren't there sort of historical precedents for this? Weren't there, you know, 19th century evangelicals running around and missionizing? And why did you choose to start it with the 70s?
Yes, this is such a good question. And absolutely, there's a really long history of evangelical missionary work and evangelical engagement in politics. That's not new. Evangelicals in the 19th century were really active in missionary work. There were even some missionaries that acted as kind of de facto ambassadors.
Oh, wow.
But there were really big differences in terms of U.S. foreign policy history in the 19th century, as well as religious history. And I think one thing that's really critical to remember is that the United States was a really weak power in the 19th century.
Yes, people forget that, yeah.
And by the mid-20th century, it's a superpower. And so the making of foreign policy itself is really quite distinct in the 19th century. By the mid-20th century, foreign policy making is professionalized, it's institutionalized. U.S. interventions abroad have really different implications by 1970 than in the 1870s. There's so much power to shape and compel the conduct of other countries. The U.S. has this massive military arsenal. It's intervening regularly. It has this coercive economic power. So just in terms of U.S. power, it's tremendously different, which is one piece of the puzzle. And of course, the evangelicals of the 20th century are different from the evangelicals of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. They share a kind of genealogical and theological legacy, but there had been so many different theological and political debates that had torn that movement apart over and over again. I mean, abolition in the 19th century tears evangelicals apart into distinct groups. There's a controversy over
abolition of slavery.
Right. Yeah. There's a controversy over fundamentalism versus modernism that tears these groups apart. such that by the 1940s, there's the emergence of a kind of new group of evangelicals, or sometimes called neo-evangelicals, which we think of this sometimes as with the establishment of the National Association of Evangelicals in 1942 as being, again, they're not completely distinct from earlier evangelicals, but they are a kind of new coalition, a new movement, one that is more ecumenical, more outward looking than their than say the fundamentalists of the 1920s. And so they are in a way a new group. And importantly, by the 1970s, they become more cohesive as a political body. One of the other things that I think we tend to forget, because we live in the period after the rise to power of the religious right, is that in the 1950s and 1960s, evangelicals were not necessarily lockstep voting for the Republican Party. That evolved over time. That became a reality in the 70s, but they weren't a guaranteed political bloc for the Republican Party before that. And so I look at, there is something specific about this period. There are key changes that happen in the 1970s that make this a turning point, a new moment for this group to seize on this moment and try to amass foreign policy power, and also to achieve their particular foreign policy objectives, which are, they have this renewed interest or this revived interest in trying to evangelize the world that is a reflection of globalization and decolonization and a number of other concerns and changes that are happening that have nothing to do with their specific theological commitments per se, but they become kind of motivated to go out into the world in a slightly, in a different way than perhaps they had in the 19th century, even though the goal of evangelizing is similar.
So there are two things, well, there are at least two major things going on. There's a change in even the nature of evangelicalism. Yeah. There's a change in the evangelical power or influence on the government, and there's a big change in the U.S.'s role in the world. So that's three things, but there are at least that many. It's not surprising, therefore, that there's this big development.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, and you know, if you think about it, the spiritual commitment, right? They look to the Bible, and one of the key things that they see, and I talk about this a lot in the book, is they look at the Great Commission that says that they are supposed to go out into all the world and make disciples of all nations.
Right.
That is a core commitment to evangelize. But what they see as they look out on the world in the 1960s and 1970s, in this world that is changing very rapidly, is there's all of this demographic change happening. There's a huge amount of population growth in parts of the global south, in Africa, Asia, elsewhere. Countries that they are worried, oh, there aren't enough evangelical missionaries there. There aren't enough local Christians there. They get this sense that there are some 2 billion people in the world who have yet to hear the Christian gospel. They better get out there and spread it, because first of all, it's their biblical commitment to do that.
Right, right.
And also just all these people, and they feel that the thing that they can best do is to provide people with salvation through Jesus Christ. And that's the best thing that they can give to the world. And from that, they start to get these ideas about human rights, right? That the fundamental human right for them is their right to evangelism and the right of other people to hear the word of God and become saved.
Right.
And from that, any other right comes. If they don't have that fundamental right, nothing else really counts, right? To them, right? That's their perception, that that's the core right, religious freedom. And so from there, you start to see that developing from a spiritual objective of fulfilling their biblical mandate to a political goal of ensuring that they can evangelize anywhere they want to in the world in a time period where there are restrictions from communist countries, where they perceive threats from countries under different types of political or religious rule.
Well, that brings up really the next question, because you say very clearly in the book that these evangelicals push Congress to grant aid to what turn out to be repressive regimes, U.S.-friendly regime, but repressive, and then to impose sanctions on countries that persecute Christians.
Yeah.
Even though they might be enemies of the United States, you know.
Yeah, it's sort of fascinating. And so what was really interesting to see is in the early 1970s, there were a number of Jewish groups in the United States who began to lobby Congress, to work really hard to get Congress to impose sanctions on the Soviet Union because it was persecuting its Jewish citizens, right? It imposed these diploma taxes. It made it very hard for them to emigrate. And it was very repressive, very abusive. And Jewish activist groups working with sympathetic members of Congress were very effective at putting sanctions on states that persecuted Jews. They passed an amendment to the 1974 Trade Act that added constraints on the U.S.'s ability to trade freely with countries that persecuted people based on being Jewish or other religious commitments, and countries that limited immigration.
Uh-huh.
And evangelical Christians were watching that, and several wrote, why aren't we doing this too? Why aren't we pushing our congressmen to impose the same kind of sanctions on countries that persecute Christians like the Soviet Union? And so they're very inspired by that, and they begin to make similar calls, right? They want to see Christian prisoners who the Soviet Union have arrested for practicing their faith. They want to see those prisoners released, somewhat unlike the situation with Jewish prisoners in the Soviet Union or Jewish people who were Jewish who were persecuted against. Many of the Christians in the Soviet bloc did not necessarily want to leave. They don't necessarily want to emigrate. Some do.
Yeah.
What they want is the freedom to practice their faith, to teach their children their faith, and to evangelize. And this sounds really good to evangelicals in the U.S. who also want those folks to be evangelizing in their country and to be converting people.
Right.
And so their goals are slightly different, right? They want to see the U.S. using its power to sanction or to restrict trade on those countries that persecute Christians so that they can kind of influence them to change their internal policies. Of course, the Soviet Union hates this,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
they don't
yeah.
want the U.S. intervening in their internal policy, and they're very resistant to this. But U.S. leaders hammer on this because of the pressure that evangelical groups place on them to free prisoners, to sanction the Soviet Union. But the flip side to that is that in repressive authoritarian regimes in places like Guatemala and elsewhere, where we have strong anti-communist forces coming to power, evangelicals look to them and they say, aha, this will provide a bulwark against the kind of governments coming to power mm-hmm. that restrict Christianity. So they start to associate that authoritarianism and anti-communism, not just on its face, like, oh, the godless communism, but literally as a way to advance the evangelistic mission around the
world.
Oh,
I see. Okay.
So it's much more complex than just the typical story of like, well, godless communism, we're opposed to it. It's they're preventing us from doing what we want to do.
Well, is there any pushback from Congress in this sort of like inconsistency or if you will, you know, certainly a difference between favoring aid to repressive regimes and but on the other hand saying no, we need to sanction certain regimes?
Absolutely, which is where it becomes very interesting, because Congress is very supportive of efforts to go after the Soviet Union and Soviet bloc countries. They're on board with that. When it comes to countries that are under authoritarian regimes that are particularly engaging in human rights abuses, like many countries in Latin America, then Congress has a real issue, particularly coming into the 1980s. There are a number of members of Congress who have very strong commitments to promoting human rights throughout the world.
Yeah.
They look at that support for authoritarian governments as a problem. They want to signal to those countries that the U.S. is not going to support countries that engage in human rights abuses. And so the calls that evangelicals and conservative politicians for support to these regimes meet stiff resistance in Congress. And this sets up a real fight between the Reagan administration and members of Congress during his term, because he, of course, is sending or attempting to send huge amounts of aid to very repressive regimes in Central and Latin America. And Congress is putting up as many roadblocks as they can. And of course, Reagan famously tried to get around them in the case of the Iran-Contra scandal, but there's a lot of resistance. And we see a similar resistance to efforts to kind of support a kind of gradualism in dealing with apartheid South Africa. So this is a story of conflict with Congress as well as working with Congress, and of how there's conflict not just between these lobbying groups, but also between the executive, the Reagan administration, and these more liberal members of Congress that comes up.
We're talking about sort of the general approach of your book and the differences between the ways in which evangelicals pressured Congress and pressure the executive branch to treat certain countries differently. Do you mind if we talk about some of those countries specifically? For instance, for obvious reasons, and you mentioned this earlier, the Soviet Union seems to be the biggie, right? Look, can we delve more into what happened there?
Absolutely. So this becomes the first real target of evangelical lobbying on these foreign policy issues. And there had already been a kind of long history of evangelicals saying, persecution is happening in the Soviet Union, we should do something. By the 1970s, that evangelicals have coalesced as a bloc that becomes effective in advocating for things like sanctions on trade. And what we start to see is, because of their sustained attention to issues such as, you know, Christian prisoners, these conversations start to be a much more regular feature in the discussions that the U.S. leadership has with their Soviet counterparts. So the ambassadors are regularly bringing up specific Christian prisoners in their conversations with their Soviet counterparts to try to put pressure on the Soviet Union to release these people. In some cases, they're effective. During the Carter administration, there's a kind of high-profile prisoner release that includes Soviet spies in exchange for not just some Americans, but also a Christian prisoner, Georgi Vins, who is released. And he doesn't want to come to the United States, but because he wants to be able to preach freely in the Soviet Union, but he has to. He's part of the deal is that he's going to come to the United States, and he comes to the United States and becomes a big activist in continuing to shed light on persecution in the Soviet Union. So they just, evangelicals become involved very regularly in pushing the U.S. to take action on this, even when that's not what U.S. leaders necessarily would want to do. Folks like Henry Kissinger and members later of the Reagan administration really favor a kind of quiet diplomacy. They don't want to have this splashed across the newspapers that this is what they're up to. They want to work behind the scenes on these issues. They don't like trade barriers that are thrown up that say you have to certify that this country is not doing X and Y thing, because it imposes restraints on their ability to make foreign policy. So they actually don't love this, but evangelicals are pushing hard for it. And evangelicals are really, not just in the Soviet Union, but in other Soviet bloc countries, they're very concerned about what's happening in Romania in the early 1980s. There's a lot of persecution in these countries at a time when the Reagan administration sees Romania as being a country that it can potentially have a slightly different relationship with. And evangelicals in the U.S. are saying, nope, you should sanction them. We should not have normal trade relations with them. And so it sets up some of these tensions. But that's really where they focus. And what's interesting is, because they are so engaged, because they are working closely with those evangelicals that they can get in touch with there, they have these relationships that they establish. When the Soviet Union starts to collapse, the leadership there actually invites evangelical groups from the U.S. to come to talk to the former KGB folks and people who were in Soviet leadership about civil society, which is so strange and not what we might have anticipated. There are actually Soviet military leaders that come to Tennessee to meet with people from the Church of God to talk about religious freedom and civil society. So they're not just influential in the United States in terms of shaping congressional policy and trade policy. Their activism gains attention even in the country that they're targeting. And so as there's change in that country, they're sort of recognized as, oh, this might be a way to kind of build up civil society in a post-Soviet Russia. It doesn't work, but they get invited. They're there. They're meeting with Gorbachev afterward. It's sort of fascinating.
Yeah, and well, and the South American country that you delve into the most is Guatemala.
And that's a totally different scenario, because there they get some pushback from Congress. So, what happens in Guatemala? In 1976, there's this huge earthquake. It rains destruction across Guatemala, and of course, many religious groups send aid in. And evangelicals kind of explicitly see this relief mission as a way not just to provide immediate medical aid or whatnot to people who are suffering, but also as an opportunity to establish churches. And they do. They establish churches throughout Guatemala. As they're there, they kind of integrate themselves into society in Guatemala, and they start to attract Guatemalan adherents. And one of the people that becomes a member of the Guatemala, of the one of these evangelical churches from the U.S., is a Guatemalan army general, Rios Montt. Now, a lot of stuff happens in Guatemala. I won't go into too much detail, but the key thing is 1982, Rios Montt, he's working at the Christian Day School. He's directing it, of this evangelical group. He hears over the radio that there's been a military coup ousting the kind of repressive leader from power. And he is being called to be one of the members of this new military junta that's going to take power. So he goes, very quickly marginalizes the other members of the junta to declare himself the leader of Guatemala. He believes, partly because of what his evangelical church members are telling him, that he's going to turn Guatemala to God. He's going to turn it into this evangelical country. sort of predominantly Catholic country is going to turn it evangelical. And evangelicals in the United States are very excited about this, especially because he has evangelical representatives working in his government. He's getting advice from U.S. Uh-huh. evangelicals, and he's promising that he's going to turn this country evangelical. And he's saying that he's going to fix the human rights situation in Guatemala.
Oh, right.
But what he actually does is he engages in a genocide against the indigenous Maya who live in uh-huh. the highlands. And evangelicals from the United States, hearing the message that he's saying, that he's going to evangelize, he's going to fix human rights, they really believe him. They think he's a man of God. They think he's going to end corruption. And they flock to him and they say, we're gonna donate huge amounts of money to you. They send ships filled with goods to him. And they lobby Congress to provide him with helicopters and military material so that he can carry out this military mission against what he calls a communist insurgency. But again, which is mostly just indigenous people living their lives.
So this is, and this is obviously, at least in theory, not what evangelical Christians should be wanting to support.
Theoretically not, but they're strongly anti-communist because they see communism as being a threat to religion. And so they're saying, well, we want to push it up against this. And they lend their support. And members, more liberal members of Congress are saying, there's a genocide happening. There's mass killing going on. He's setting up strategic hamlets.
Yeah, yeah.
This is not something we want to support. And they will not give that money over. And so the evangelicals have these meetings with folks like the head of the Organization of American States and some of the other ambassadors from the United from the US, people like Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, they're advocating for support for these guys for Rios Montt. And Reagan eventually goes down to meet with Rios Montt. And even though he's cautioned against kind of throwing his arms around this dictator, you can tell he's really taken with the rhetoric, right? This guy's, you know, he's a Christian. He's committed to these Christian beliefs. So he's going to do things better for Guatemala. And he really buys into that. And they then become very effective at trying to marshal aid for that Guatemalan leader. When Congress proves resistant, evangelical activists go around them. They look to sources in Canada and Israel and elsewhere to get the kind of military material and helicopter parts that Rios Montt needs.
Yeah.
So they're able to support him. They try to support him through lobbying. When that doesn't work, they support him in other ways. And that affects life on the ground in Guatemala. Now, Rios Montt eventually gets overthrown and replaced with a perhaps even more repressive, although it's not a repression Olympics, they're all bad, yeah. leader. The sort of decades-long civil war continues, but evangelicals stayed there. They continued to be part of that structure that was working in Guatemala. So they're there on the ground. Some of them doing what they see as humanitarian work, but they're also, you know, trying to continue to spread their churches.
Well, then how do evangelicals approach a country like South Africa, which in many ways is the government is Christian, of course, but or at least Christian background. But then, of course, there's this system of apartheid.
Yeah. So the South Africa case is so interesting to me because we have this huge array of opinion from evangelicals. Uh-huh. So to get at your big question, they see South Africa as the Christian country in the continent of
right.
Africa that needs to be defended against the threat from Marxism or from communism. So they see the African National Congress as a Marxist organization.
Yeah, sure.
Which is not. So they see it as a communist threat. So they need to defend it. But many evangelicals also recognize that the apartheid system that is in place, this repressive mm-hmm. racist system, makes it hard for them to evangelize. And so we see this wide range of opinion. Now, obviously, in the United States, there's also a lot of Black Christians, right? Black evangelicals. They are very strongly engaged with anti-apartheid activism. And some of them support this kind of corporate responsibility thing like Leon Sullivan introduced, but most of them are for sanctions and mm-hmm. disinvestment. Most white evangelicals in the United States say that they abhor apartheid, but there's a range of opinion. There are folks like Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell who are making very vile statements about the anti-apartheid activists like, you know, Desmond Tutu and others. There are some in the Southern Baptist Convention who embrace divestment, mm-hmm. right? Who want their legislators to pass legislation to challenge apartheid. So there's a huge amount of variation of opinion. In South Africa, there's variation of opinion. There's just a range of evangelical opinion there too. For U.S. evangelicals, though, on the whole, white U.S. evangelicals, they want a gradual end to mm-hmm. apartheid, They don't want to have Marxism come into play, but they also recognize that they need to do something so that evangelism can take place. So what ends up happening there is they become opponents of the movement for sanctions and disinvestment, which the Reagan administration, that's what they want. They want to avoid sanctions and disinvestment. When Congress proposes a comprehensive anti-apartheid act, the Reagan administration explicitly looks to evangelical leaders to help them sell their opposition to Congress and the public. So they look for Black evangelicals from South Africa to come and explain on their TV programs that if they support kind of radical anti-apartheid, by which they mean an immediate end to apartheid, that it's going to invite Marxism and communism and everything's going to kind of collapse, and that it will damage human rights for the people worst off. And of course, this is completely ridiculous, right? But that's what they do. So they try to provide kind of moral grounding for the Reagan administration to oppose the sanction and disinvestment movement. And they're not successful. Right. Congress passes the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act. Reagan vetoes it, and they pass it over his veto. So it gets put in place. But what matters is that even though they're not successful in convincing Congress or the public that there should be this gradual end to apartheid, the fact that the Reagan administration looks to them to help try to sell that policy just shows how influential they become as foreign policy thinkers, as foreign policy leaders by this time.
Yeah.
What's also interesting is that in South Africa, there are white South African evangelicals who really gradually come to see that gradualism as an affront to their faith. And some actually end up participating in peace and reconciliation.
You mean gradualism really accepting
a gradual end to apartheid, which sounds just as bad as a gradual end to civil rights here, right? That's not, and they come to see that, but it's such a slow and painful process for them to get to that point. And it's a similar slow and painful process in the United States.
But the sort of depth of involvement and influence in American foreign policy that these, again, non-state actors have during this period is amazing. And it's very compressed, but it's very intensive.
And it's diffuse, because these are many different groups acting toward a common goal, but not necessarily all coordinating. Some folks may have watched the Netflix series On the Family, right? The Fellowship Foundation, which was this kind of shadowy DC Christian organization that aimed at getting the leaders of the world to kind of come together in prayer groups. Well, one of the things that the DC, the sort of headquarters of the Fellowship Foundation, they had cell groups around the world, including in South Africa. And they said that their goal was to bring together evangelicals and Christians in leadership in South Africa to try to, you know, work through some of the problems they were having. So they're not just having an influence at home, they're actually trying to get influence in governments abroad as well,
right,
through the National Prayer Breakfast and that sort of thing. So it's very diffuse. It's many different groups. There's some overlap of the kind of work that they do, but they're all influential. They're all the sort of combined efforts become very influential by the 1980s.
It's absolutely gripping, the book, and we of course encourage the Buzzkillers to go to the Buzzkill bookshelf and pick it up. We're going to ask Cornell University Press to send us a copy to give away to one of our Patreon members, but that hasn't happened yet. We're hoping that it'll work. So it just remains for me to say thank you very much, Professor, for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really exciting to get to talk to you about this.
Well, and we hope that the Buzzkillers out there will give them really something to think about, because it, in many ways, it seems so long ago because of the way you're talking about the influence in the government, but it was, you know, certainly within living memory, certainly within living memory of my lifetime. So let's just say thanks again.
Thank you.
We'll say to you Buzzkillers out there that we'll talk to you next week.